from Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S.-Israeli division on the Iran nuclear debate. Brutality is reported eroding ISS financial support. A U.N. council says human rights are being violated to a shocking degree. Climate change is being called a factor in two disasters, Syria and California. And on a lighter note, horseback riders kick off rodeo season in Houston. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu delivers an address today to a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress, expected to warn that a pending comprehensive nuclear agreement between a U.S.-led coalition and Iran could threaten the survival of the Jewish state. President Obama, in a Reuters interview Monday, asked the negotiations with Tehran be allowed to play out. He expressed confidence an agreement would most likely prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Since an interim agreement was reached in November of 2013, the United States, its coalition partners, and Iran have been working to reach an agreement on Iran's uranium enrichment levels that addresses Western concerns that Iran has nuclear weapons ambitions. Iran, in return, is seeking relief from international sanctions. They have been trying to reach a framework agreement by the end of March. The two sides hope to have a final agreement by the end of June. Middle East analyst Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Obama administration appears to enjoy wide international support for its negotiating effort.
Clearly, it is very much in the interest of the United States as well as the international community to try to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. So this idea that somehow Israeli Prime Minister has particular insights that the broad coalition negotiators in the Iran talks somehow have missed out on seems a little far-fetched, especially since there are reports in the Israeli media that a fair number of leading Israeli security analysts tend to agree with the Obama administration and other international leaders more than they do with their prime minister.
What do you make of Mr. Obama's revelation of at least a 10-year freeze on nuclear development?
Clearly, given how long and drawn out and difficult the negotiations have been to even get to this point, clearly they do not want anything that's of a shorter term than this. Also, I think there is hope within the international community that the reform movement in Iran, which is growing, especially with a younger generation that is desiring a closer cooperation with the West and an end to Iran's international isolation, will be in a stronger place politically 10 years from now, so that a stronger agreement can be reached, and Iran will not be seen as quite the pariah and potential threat that it is today.
The French press agency says Israel believes an agreement as short as 10 or 20 years would mean Iran would arrive at the threshold of being a nuclear weapons power in virtually the same political environment as today.
Their hopes, I think, are less than most of the international community, and I would argue most Iranians. In any case, even if they did break out of the agreement 10 years from now, the provisions regarding inspections and monitoring are such that it would take at minimum a year, even with a full throttle effort, for Iran to actually develop a nuclear weapon. So there appears to be sufficient safeguards in place, even in the worst-case scenario. But a lot of what will determine whether Iran goes in the direction of wanting a nuclear deterrent will depend a lot on the perceived threats against it. Though Iran, of course, is an authoritarian regime under an Islamist rule, what gives them power in these kinds of international disputes is their ability to play on the Iranian strong sense of nationalism and their ability to manipulate the fears that Iran has, given the history of foreign intervention in that country. So it would seem that if their goal is to encourage the ascendancy of more moderate elements within Iran, certainly going a diplomatic path rather than sanctions and war would be the way to go.
Zunis says given Iran's advances in missile technology that coincide with its nuclear program, there are elements within Iran who would like to see it develop a nuclear deterrent capability. However, he says developing nuclear weapons would actually make it less secure and give its enemies an excuse to threaten war. Zunis says this would serve as an incentive for Tehran to pursue a nuclear agreement. Monday at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee conference, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu noted the rift between the United States and Israel.
Israel and the United States agree that Iran should not have nuclear weapons. But we disagree on the best way to prevent Iran from developing those weapons. Now, disagreements among allies are only natural from time to time, even among the closest of allies. Because there are important differences between America and Israel. The United States of America is a large country, one of the largest. Israel is a small country, one of the smallest. America lives in one of the world's safest neighborhoods. Israel lives in the world's most dangerous neighborhood. America is the strongest power in the world. Israel is strong, but it's much more vulnerable. American leaders worry about the security of their country. Israeli leaders worry about the survival of their country.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said Israel and the United States are more than friends, they are family, and the alliance between them is sound. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif met again today in the latest round of talks aimed at finding a framework agreement to ensure Iran's nuclear program is peaceful. The talks in Montreux, Switzerland, were the second in as many days for the diplomats as they work on the details of curbing Iran's nuclear activities in exchange for relief from sanctions that have hurt the country's economy. Kerry and Zarif are expected to meet through Wednesday. Before Monday's session, Zarif told reporters that ending the sanctions is key to advancing the deal. Kerry said Iran must be willing to make the difficult decisions that will be required in order for there to be a deal.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The top U.S. intelligence official says the Islamic State's penchant for publicizing beheadings and other brutal acts is hurting the terror group's bottom line. VOA National Security reporter Jeff Selden reports.
Slowly but surely, U.S. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper says the Islamic State's proving to be its own worst enemy.
These brutalities, publicized brutalities by ISIL, beheadings and immolations and the like, have really had a galvanizing effect even in the Mideast.
Clapper, speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, says the strongest evidence comes from donations, which he says have seen a big decline.
The amount of donations that ISIL got was a very, very less than 1% of their total revenue from last year.
Clapper says some of the decline is also due to increased oversight from governments across the Middle East, sometimes with U.S. help. Just last month, a top U.S. Treasury official said Washington had been having some important successes in denying the Islamic State access to revenue and in limiting its ability to use money it did have. But donations are just one way the Islamic State gets its money, with robbery and extortion, oil sales, and ransoms all generating more revenue. Clapper also warns stifling the Islamic State's finances will not be enough, and that the U.S. is still struggling to counter the group's narrative, given America's general lack of popularity in parts of the Muslim world.
I think in the end, our ability to do that and to really influence change in attitudes and change in worldview is only going to come about when the people there themselves do that.
Clapper also noted difficulties encountering the Islamic State in Syria, which he said is compounded by the fact that, unlike with Iraq, the U.S. is actually not there. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
Discrimination, racism, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism are among the many disquieting issues to be explored at this session of the U.N. Human Rights Council. The four-week meeting is opening with a four-day high-level segment during which senior officials will discuss issues of national interest and global concern. Lisa Schlein reports from the council meeting in Geneva.
By video link from New York, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon weighed in on the importance of nations to do their utmost to combat human rights violations, which continue to escalate in many parts of the world.
The world faces serious violations of human rights, from discrimination and inequality to oppression and violent extremism. Our shared challenge is to do far more to keep these and other abuses from occurring in the first place. The conflict in Syria offers just one example where early United Nations efforts to address human rights violations might have averted a human and political catastrophe.
Ban says the United Nations has the mandate and tools to prevent such disasters. Unfortunately, he notes, these tools often go unused because countries, for political reasons, cannot agree on what action to take. In the case of Syria, the United Nations estimates more than 200,000 people have been killed in this conflict, which is entering its fifth year. It says 12.2 million Syrians are in need of aid, including the 7.6 million internally displaced people. Another 4 million Syrians have sought refuge in neighboring countries. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayd Raad al-Hussein opened the council with a criticism of countries, he said, often put their own interests ahead of the human rights of their citizens. He said he's especially disturbed by the contempt and disregard displayed by several states towards the women and men appointed by them as independent experts, and by the reprisals and smear campaigns frequently targeted against them.
Some policymakers persuade themselves that their circumstances are exceptional, creating a wholly new reality unforeseen by the law. This logic is abundant around the world today. In reality, neither terrorism, nor globalization, nor migration are qualitatively new threats that can justify overturning the legal foundations of life on Earth. They are not new.
The High Commissioner says it is the duty and responsibility of governments to protect the rights of their people, not deprive them of these rights. Highlights of the four-week council session include presentations by the Independent Commissions of Inquiry on Syria, Eritrea, and the 2014 Gaza conflict. It will present reports on the human rights situation in Iraq in light of abuses committed by the so-called Islamic State, and will discuss the situations in North Korea, Iran, Burma, Central African Republic, Ivory Coast, and Mali, among others. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Climate change helped set off a chain of events that likely led to the Syrian civil war, according to a new study. Another report in the same journal says the record-breaking drought crippling the most populous and most productive state in the U.S. bears the same hallmark of climate change. The two point to the possibility of clear and present dangers from a threat often considered far in the future. VOA's Steve Barragona has details.
From 2007 to 2010, Syria was devastated by the worst drought in the country's recorded history. Climatologist and lead study author Colin Kelly says crops failed and livestock died, driving an estimated 1.5 million people from their homes.
And these people picked up their families and en masse migrated to the urban areas to try and survive. You know, they weren't thinking about the future. They were thinking about the present.
Kelly says they fled to cities already overburdened by as many as 1.5 million refugees from the Iraq war. Shantytowns sprung up that were breeding grounds of discontent that erupted in 2011. In the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Kelly and colleagues write that the drought that pushed the cities over the edge was made more likely by climate change. The group found that the warming and drying trend the region has experienced since the mid-20th century fits well with what models predict from increased greenhouse gases.
When you include the long-term trend, that you were 2 to 3 times more likely to have multi-year droughts that were as severe as the most recent one.
But, he adds, it was not just the drought that did it.
We're not saying that global warming or climate change triggered or caused the uprising in Syria. What we are saying is that it basically exacerbated the drought that occurred, made it more severe the most severe in the observed record, and that this set about a chain of events that ultimately led to the uprising.
Meanwhile, another study in the journal suggests climate change has made more likely the kind of crippling drought facing the U.S. state of California. 1 in 8 Americans lives in California. The state produces 12% of the nation's GDP and more than 10% of its farm income. Noah Diffenbaugh is a Stanford University climate scientist. He says California has wet years and dry years.
We do know from looking at the historical record that low precipitation years have been much more likely, greater than 2 times as likely, to produce severe drought if they co-occur with warm conditions. And what we've found in California is that there's been a very clear long-term warming.
In new research, he and his colleagues say that's made a drought like the current one more probable.
That increase in probability doesn't occur without the human contribution of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere.
And in both California and Syria, the studies say the future looks to be warmer and drier still. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
The annual Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, the largest event of its kind in the world, kicked off on Saturday with a downtown parade featuring trail riders from all over Texas and even as far as the Mexican border region. The trail riders are themselves part of a tradition that dates back to 1952. VOA's Greg Flakus reports that tradition remains strong, even though Houston's urban area has grown much larger.
Every year, the Houston rodeo season begins with a parade downtown. The riders brave highways and city streets to get here. Tim Bronado came in with a group from a rural area north of the city.
It's getting harder every year for us just to find stops, to be able to stop safely and be safely on the side of the roads, to have our brakes stop.
But these trail riders don't sleep on the cold, hard ground the way old-time cowboys did. Rancher James Money rode in from Booth, Texas, about 45 kilometers away, and slept every night along the way in a comfortable camp trailer.
I don't know if we're as hard as the old-timers. You know, we have to have luxuries to be able to do it.
The day before the parade, riders make their last camp in Houston's Memorial Park. Here they can relax and practice their cowboy skills.
Congratulations on an outstanding trail ride.
There's also an award ceremony. Among the spectators was a visitor from Germany, Charula Palwitz.
It's very nice to see a little bit of the culture here and get a little bit of the mood here of Texas.
The big winner at the awards ceremony was the Texas Independence Trail Ride from Brazoria, Texas. Joey Bolaños is among the proud winners.
It's like the best of the best. Organization, the horsemanship, and safety and all that.
Tradition is the most important element of the trail ride for rancher Ed Coes.
It's part of my heritage. My daddy was a rancher and farmer. His daddy was a rancher and farmer. We all were at one time in this Houston area. So we got to keep this going.
Most trail riders are not ranchers, but they need to tend to their animals year-round. 10-year-old Kevin says he does that work at home, although his little sisters disagree.
He don't ride his horses at home. He don't do hardly nothing at home with his horses.
I do.
The Barn Bunch riders even bring along their own specially designed fire barrel for the cold nights. The boss of the crew, Daphne Johnson, says the week-long ride can be tiring.
By Wednesday, everybody's saying, oh, my gosh, I can't wait until this is over. By the time we get to the park, we're saying, oh, no, the trail is almost over. And then on Sunday, we're planning for next year.
Johnson says she enjoys spending time every year with others who enjoy a taste of cowboy life. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Houston.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. You can also re-listen to this program if you like. Just go to voanews.com, go to the Programs tab, and scroll on down to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 3rd, 1776, America's revolutionary leaders dispatched Continental Congress delegate Silas Deane to France. His secret mission was to purchase munitions and recruit French officers to help train and lead the American army in the war for independence from Britain. French help was decisive in the war. In 1836, delegates representing the people of Texas, now a state in the U.S., adopt a Declaration of Independence from Mexico. For the next 10 years, the Republic of Texas was an independent country. Inventor Alexander Graham Bell was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, on this day in 1847. As a young man, Bell emigrated to the United States, where he began work on ways to transmit the human voice by telegraph. With the help of an experienced electrical designer and mechanic named Thomas Watson, Bell won the race to the patent office, as well as subsequent lawsuits filed by competitors, to become widely recognized as the inventor of the telephone. On this day in 1931, band leader and jazz singer Cab Calloway and his orchestra recorded the song that was to become his trademark, Minnie the Moocher.
Folks, now here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a red-hot hoochie-coocher.
After the song appeared in a Betty Boop cartoon in which Calloway, through the wonders of animation, also appeared, Minnie the Moocher became a huge hit. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Her first name means hope, but friends and family of Nadia Savchenko are increasingly afraid that the Ukrainian pilot and parliamentarian imprisoned by Russia may not survive her detention. A former military pilot, Ms. Savchenko, was seized by Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine in June and forcibly taken into Russia. She has been accused of complicity in the killing of two Russian journalists, a charge she has rejected as absolutely false. In October, while in prison, Ms. Savchenko was elected in absentia to Ukraine's parliament and named a delegate to the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. In December, she began a hunger strike to protest the conditions of her detention, and her health is in decline. On February 25th, an appeals court in Moscow refused to move up her trial date, which had been set for May 13th, and insisted she remain in pretrial custody. Her lawyer, Nikolai Polozov, reportedly said her condition is increasingly dangerous. "We are getting close to the point when there are just days left before she would no longer be able to stand on her own feet, before she can no longer live," he is quoted as saying. In a written statement, State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki voiced deep concern over the decision by the Russian court to continue Ms. Savchenko's detention, noting her months-long hunger strike to protest being held hostage by Russian authorities. Ms. Psaki said the United States deplores her continued ill treatment and is deeply concerned by reports of her deteriorating health. "By any standard, Russia's detention and treatment of Ms. Savchenko is unacceptable," said spokesperson Psaki. "We call on Russia to honor its commitment under the September 2014 Minsk agreements and the February 15th implementation plan by immediately releasing Nadia Savchenko and all other Ukrainian hostages."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.